Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission Thursday, November 4th meeting. Thank you all for attending, and we don't have everyone here. We also have others in a room on the premise just for distancing, but hopefully they can hear, see, and will be able to come in at the appropriate time. Before we get started, I'm going to take a roll call. Applin, present.
Eagle, present.
Hildebrand, present.
Foster, present.
Rowling, present.
Stop, present.
Thank you. This meeting is called to order on November 4th at 9:09 a.m. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Carter Smith has a statement he'd like to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, a public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551. Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. As a reminder, commissioners, if you'll state your name and speak slowly before so the court reporter can get it. First is the approval of minutes from the commission meeting August 26, 2021, which have been distributed. I need a motion and a second.
I'll move. Foster.
Foster.
Bell seconds.
Bell second. All those in favor signify by aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Next is acknowledgement of the list of donations which has been distributed. Need a motion for approval?
So moved, Hildebrand.
Hildebrand. Scott second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. By the way, thank y'all so much for the donations. They're incredible. Month after month, year after year, the donations that are made to the agency are just so much appreciated and go to such good. So thank everyone for that. Next is consideration of contracts which have been distributed. Is there a motion for approval? Scott?
Over in second.
Hildebrand, second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Item number one is a designation of nonprofit partners. Back to that donation we were visiting about, our nonprofit partners recommended adoption of proposed changes. Ms. Brittany Zepeda, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
Please make your presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Brittany Zepeda, and I'm the Texas State Parks Volunteer Program Manager. I'm requesting designation of nonprofit partners. We have decades of partnerships dating back to the 1930s, and in 1991, Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation was established as the official nonprofit partner. One of the legislative guidances enacted in 2001 was that the commission vote on the designation of nonprofit partners. While we work closely with many nonprofits like CCA or Ducks Unlimited, these designated nonprofits are considered closely related nonprofit partners that exist primarily for the purpose of a specific facility or program. Nonprofit partners must follow rules of federal and state law. They are to be organized as a nonprofit corporation and follow the Texas Nonprofit Corporation Act. Work must be consistent with the agency's mission and goals. There will be a written agreement between the nonprofit partner and the agency, and nonprofits are designated by the commission in a public meeting. Groups may be removed from the list by the commission. You can find the list of nonprofits in your agenda, including the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation as the official nonprofit. So the recommended action today would be approval of the list of nonprofit partners. Thank you so much for your time. Do you have any questions?
Brittany, thank you. Commissioners, any questions for Brittany, nonprofit partners? Okay. Hearing none, no discussion. And we do not have anybody that has registered to speak on item number one. Correct, Dee?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So if there's no comments from commissioners and no one to speak, then I'll take a motion by a commissioner.
I'll
So moved. Foster.
Foster, second. Galo, second. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Hearing none. Motion passes. Thank you, Brittany.
Thank you.
Action item number two, coastal thermal refuge area closures, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Good morning, Brian. Make your presentation, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and fellow commissioners. For the record, my name is Brian Bartram. I'm the ecosystem leader with the Corpus Christi Bay ecosystem. Today, I'll be presenting the results of the public hearing that followed the proposed freeze closure rules and freeze closure area additions and changes that were presented at the August commission meeting. As y'all know, the department maintains a list of closure areas that the executive director may close to angling during freezing conditions. We propose the addition of new closure areas as well as some changes to existing sites. We also propose some definitional changes to the Texas Administrative Code to better define the conditions that constitute a freeze as well as reopening criteria. And the changes we are proposing include clarifying the definition of an affected area. Now, this proposed language gives us the ability to include the other areas that will serve as a thermal refuge but do not necessarily have bank access. We are also proposing language that will define a freeze using lethal water temperatures rather than air temperatures. This threshold would be set at 40 degrees Fahrenheit, as this is the water temperature at which species like spotted sea trout and red drum begin to suffer cold-related mortality. We're also proposing language that will allow the executive director to notify the public of forthcoming closures in anticipation of a freeze rather than after a freeze has occurred. And we're also seeking to establish reopening criteria based on water temperatures as measured by select NOAA stations, NOAA tide stations. And once water temperatures reach a minimum of 50 degrees Fahrenheit and are expected to remain above 40 degrees Fahrenheit for at least 48 hours, the executive director may then allow fishing to resume in those affected areas. So our staff, along with input from law enforcement, are recommending keeping 17 sites as is, adding 16 new sites, modifying two, and combining four with one new site to create one large site. And just to make the distinction, these newly proposed areas are not part of the code, but we did seek public input on these areas. A virtual coastwide public hearing was held on October 14th, and during this meeting, the proposed changes to the Texas Administrative Code and maps of the newly proposed closure areas, as well as maps detailing any changes to existing sites, were presented to the public. For the hearing, we had six registered attendees, two that attended, and the only comment received during the hearing was a comment seeking clarification on the Little Bay closure area. The old map, which is no longer viewable on the public-facing webpage, showed only the canal subdivisions to the east as being closed. The new map will accurately reflect the text description of the closure site and will include all the waters of Little Bay in the map. We also received 14 comments through the public comment portal on our webpage, 13 that agree completely and one disagree. And I'll add here that CCA has voiced their support of these proposals as well. The disagree comment, that individual actually agreed with the proposals but wanted to express their concern about detrimental impacts to marine resources from barge movement through the intercoastal waterway during freezing conditions. And to that point, I wanted to emphasize that these suspensions of barge traffic are voluntary and temporary, and our relationship with the Gulf Intercoastal Canal Association has been very positive. They have been very cooperative and accommodating in previous requests of suspension of barge traffic, and ultimately the authority to suspend this barge traffic lies with the U.S. Coast Guard. So today, our staff are recommending the adoption of proposed changes to the freeze closure section of the Texas Administrative Code as published in the September 24th, 2021 issue of the Texas Register. Welcome any questions at this time.
Thank you, Brian. Any questions, discussions by the commission? We don't have anybody that requested to speak on this matter. Therefore, if there's no comments, questions by the commission, I'll accept a motion and a second.
Commissioner Bell makes a motion.
Bell.
Hildebrand, second.
Hildebrand, second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. Action item two, thermal refuge. Passes. Done.
Thank you.
Thank you. Action item number three, digital license and tagging requirements, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Mr. Robin Rikers. Robin, good morning.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Robin Rikers. I'm Director of Coastal Fisheries, and as indicated, I'm here to present to you the proposed adoption to allow digital recreational license and tagging. And it is a, as we have discussed, it is a pilot program. It would be established for the license year of 2023, which means the licenses would be ready to go on sale in August of next year. It'll be available on our TBWD website, and it's in the pilot program aspect of it. It's going to apply to the super combination, the senior super combo, and the lifetime super combo. And of course, in order to do this, we're going to use the My Texas Hunt Harvest application to basically create our digital tagging. As we've discussed in the prior times, basically what we have to do is create an optional issuance of a digital license and tag. So we have to basically create an exception to the physical license and tag requirements that we currently now have. And so that's what is completed in Exhibit A. And, of course, you'll have to have that proof of receipt on a smartphone, tablet, or similar device. In Exhibit B, of course, what we're doing here is allowing, actually creating the framework for what creates a digital tag. And so this one in particular creates the digital tagging for Red Drum. Basically, the harvest report will be filled out and submitted immediately. If you are in network availability, you'll get a confirmation number, and that will be the end of it if you are doing Red Drum. If you are out of network availability, then as quickly as you can, and when you enter network availability, that would upload to the system. In Exhibit C, we're actually creating the digital tagging for the deer and turkey aspects of the super combo. Again, harvest reports generated immediately. If you get a confirmation number on that, then that will be attached to the turkey or the deer, the animal in this case. And that's all you have to put on the animal. If you are outside of network connectivity, we are proposing that you put on a hunter document, a first and last name, a customer number of license holder, and the date and time of harvest. And then obviously it too uploads immediately upon network availability. In the public comment portion of this, we have received 1 in support and 5 in opposition. With that, here's the recommendation that staff would recommend. Staff would recommend that we adopt amendments concerning fees, concerning stamps, concerning bag possession and length limits, and concerning statewide hunting and fishing proclamation with changes as necessary to proposed text, as was published in the September 24, 2021 issue of the Texas Register. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Robin, Commissioners?
Patton, I actually had one that I thought of last night as I was laying in bed thinking about these things. I don't know how they pop in my mind, but this may be like a code writing part of the digital software. But to avoid someone that was going to go to a sporting goods store and get a paper tag and then at the same time get the digital tag for the sole purpose of having additional large red drum tags. You see where I'm going with that?
Yep.
They might have a paper tag in one hand and on their smartphone have the ability to have 2 more tags. And maybe even the way the paper tags work, you could have 2 paper tags. So are we going to be able to know if someone went and got a paper tag that they then should not be able to download or take advantage of this program? You see where did I do that okay? Or
No, I think I know the question. I'm going to turn and see if Justin is in the room, and I don't know that he is.
This would be something to think about as we roll out that.
Sure, sure. No, how I will answer this is certainly as we opt in, they are supposed to either opt in to the digital or the paper, and that's the way we're trying to control that when they opt in. As far as whether there can be duplicates issued, the system should be able to catch that, and we'll certainly try to make sure as we develop it, as you're suggesting, that we create that mousetrap, if you will.
I'm not saying I would ever do that.
Robin, Commissioner Bell, 1 question. You had mentioned that there were one in support and five in opposition. What was just the nature of the opposition comments?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't cover that this morning. They did not express what their opposition was. As I suggested yesterday, the only thing I can maybe suspect is that they thought it was going to be mandatory in some way. And, of course, this is a completely voluntary opt-in situation. But as we indicated yesterday, we're going to certainly make sure that as we roll this out, because this is going to be a new thing for us, we're going to be way in front of it as far as getting the word out and getting communication out in our outdoor annual and on the web and use all of our media opportunities to do that.
Robin, under the paper tag system, if you catch an oversized redfish, you tag it. Then I understand you can go to a provider and ask for the second tag. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Have y'all thought of what's the plan digitally? Can you tag two deer? Can you tag two redfish oversized on the same fishing trip, or is there a delay?
There shouldn't be a delay. They should be able to go online, enter their first tag, and then get their second tag.
And is that your goal?
We certainly have no biological reason not to allow that.
Okay. Yeah. Questions, any other commissioners? Okay, no one has signed up to speak about digital licensing. Commissioner Bell, thank you for bringing that up about the nays. I think it was just because, as Robin said, need a motion for approval. Patton, second. Rowling, second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, hearing none. Motion passes. Thank you, Robin. Action item number four, proposed amendments to the exotic, harmful, or potentially harmful fish, shellfish, and aquatic plant rules. Recommended adoption of proposed changes. Good morning, Monica. You're up.
Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Monica McGarity, and I'm the Senior Scientist for Aquatic Invasive Species Management in the Inland Fisheries Division. Today, I'll be presenting on proposed amendments to the exotic, harmful, or potentially harmful fish, shellfish, and aquatic plants rules that were presented to the Commission in August. Aquatic invasive species harm ecosystems, recreation, the economy, and even human health and quality of life. Parks and Wildlife statutes establish prohibitions against activities involving these species and give the Commission the authority to regulate their legal possession and use. TPWD regulations for these exotic species, as is the case in most states, take the form of a prohibited species list, and the primary focus of the list is prevention. Only a few of the listed species are allowed for use, and the goal of the regulation is ultimately to prevent introduction or escape and subsequent impacts. The proposed changes to the exotic species rules would clarify that permits are specific to ponds for which they were issued and set a permit period of validity of 18 months for triploid grass carp stocking permits. Currently, the permits do not expire until all authorized fish have been purchased. However, recent rule changes that no longer require sellers to provide sales invoices to the department make it such that permits expiration cannot be determined, and thus these permits must be archived by the department indefinitely. Having an expiration date will also prevent potential reuse of the permits, which are issued digitally as a PDF and could be reprinted. The 18-month time frame was selected to allow for adaptive management, as some fish can be stocked during the first year, followed by the remaining fish in the second year if needed. This applies to the permit period during which fish can be stocked, after which the sales transport invoice and proof of triploid status that are required to be retained would serve as the proof of lawful possession. The rules also allow for and clarify the process for lawful transfer of these long-lived fish with the transfer of a property to new ownership, specifying that the documentation required for possession be transferred to the new owner. Under the current rules, there is no exception for such transfers of triploid grass carp, which are necessitated by property transfers. The proposed rules also clarify rules on harvest of triploid grass carp from stocked public waters. The changes remove mention of harvest after permit expiration date, as 18 months is not adequate for the fish to do their work of aquatic vegetation management. The changes also more accurately describe the process whereby the department lists on the website water bodies from which AAA grass carp may not be taken because they're still needed for vegetation management versus specifically authorizing removal as currently described in regulations. The department sought to seek public feedback from the regulated community through multiple actions. An email notice of the opportunity to comment summarizing the proposed rules was emailed to nearly 5,000 individuals who had obtained AAA grass carp stocking permits in the past 5 years, as well as to 35 permitted AAA grass carp sellers. The same notice was also shared with pond managers, many of whom are permitted sellers, via the Texas Aquatic Plant Management Society newsletter. Finally, a presentation on the proposed rule changes was provided at the October 12th meeting of the Texas Freshwater Fisheries Advisory Committee. A total of 28 public comments was received, with 21 disagreeing with the proposed rules, 5 agreeing, and 2 expressing no opinion. Specific comments received from 18 individuals primarily objected to the proposed 18-month period of permit validity as inadequate. The comments noted that longer time may be needed to determine the effectiveness of an initial partial stocking, or that they implemented a phased stocking approach over the course of a longer period of time. It was also noted that some permit holders had experienced delays, some longer than 18 months, in obtaining AAA grass carp to stock, due to supply issues that have been exacerbated by freeze and also droughts. 2 commented with concerns that existing permits should be exempt from the permit period of validity. And we would note that this is simply a misunderstanding, as the proposed rule changes would not affect existing permits, only those issued after the effective date of the proposed rules. One individual commented that requiring transfer of AAA grass carp documentation with the sale of the property to a new owner would be problematic, as it would require verifying whether the fish are alive. However, individuals in possession of these fish are currently required to retain this documentation for the life of the fish and should have this information in their possession if they believe the fish to be alive. Thus, transfer of this documentation should be feasible, and the intent of this rule is simply to establish a lawful means for these fish to be transferred that's currently not available to these property owners. One individual commented that the economics of this proposal to private landowners is detrimental and not taken into consideration without providing specifics, but mentioning the potential refunding of the $2 per fish fee for fish not stocked during the permit period of validity. Individuals wishing to stock AAA grass carp over a period longer than the permit period of validity would need to obtain another permit at a base administrative cost of $27. As I'll discuss in our proposed response to public comment, we believe that the possible need for multiple permits and associated costs can be reduced by addressing the proposed permit period of validity. With regards to the refunding of per fish fees, permit applicants will be aware of the permit period of validity at the time of permit application and will be able to seek a permit for the correct number of fish for that time period, such that refunds would not be needed. One commented related to the proposed change to enable triploid grass carp to be lawfully transferred with property transfer that there's not a need to retain the documentation of lawful possession. However, this is not a new requirement, and it's merely reiterated with regards to property transfers. Of the 21 individuals disagreeing with the proposed rules, 18 provided feedback specific to the period of validity duration or provided details on how they stock these fish over time that could be used to generate an estimate of the time they believed a permit would be needed. Nearly half simply indicated that 18 months was inadequate without proposing an alternative. Alternative periods proposed ranged from 2 to 5 years. Feedback from the Texas Freshwater Fisheries Advisory Committee advised that 3 years is a reasonable duration, and it was noted that pond managers typically do not advise extended stocking over a longer time period. In response to the feedback received on the proposed rule changes, staff recommend amending the proposed rule to extend the permit period of validity to 3 years as opposed to 18 months. We believe that this duration would take into consideration the stated need of respondents. Extending the period to 2 years was considered. However, a six-month extension from 18 months to 2 years would likely only add late fall and winter months to the permit, during which these fish are typically not stocked, whereas a permit period of 3 years would add another entire spring and summer stocking season. The proposed amendment would address both the administrative needs related to indefinite permit archiving and accommodate the needs of the regulated community, including reducing the potential need for multiple permits with associated $27 fees. With that, staff recommends that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts amendments to 31 Texas Administrative Code Section 57.113 concerning general provisions and exceptions, and 57.116 concerning special provisions triploid grass carp, with changes if necessary to the proposed text as published in the September 24, 2021 issue of the Texas Register. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. McGarity. Questions for Monica from the commission? Comments? I appreciate the fact that you guys looked into this and made some modifications on your recommendation based on the overwhelming comments that you got, so thank you for that. Need a motion from a commissioner. Galo, motion, second. Second, Scott, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Monica. Action item number 5, chronic waste disease detection and response, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Mitch, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Vice Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood. I'm the Big Game Program Director in the Wildlife Division. And this morning, staff seek adoption of proposed amendments to the comprehensive CWD rules. And these amendments are important because, as you've heard on a number of occasions, the epidemiology of this situation that we've been dealing with since the spring has indicated that the comprehensive CWD rules adopted by the Commission in June of 2016 were not effective at achieving our goals of early detection and containment of this disease. We believe that modifying enhancing some of the surveillance requirements for deer breeding facilities can address many of the shortcomings. Now, as you all know, this has been a very transparent process since the spring. We've had many meetings of various stakeholder groups, several meetings of our CWD task force, our private lands advisory committee, our whitetail deer and mule deer advisory committees, and a meeting with our deer breeder user group as well. We've had meetings with elected officials, we've had a legislative hearing on the subject, we've had public meetings with Texas Animal Health Commission, with this commission, and certainly have vetted these ideas through numerous stakeholders through the process. Now, having said that, we have noticed some oversights in the proposal since it was published in the Texas Register, but we've decided not to try and address those oversights at this time, and But like I did share with you yesterday, we do recommend some corrections, a few corrections to the proposed text based on some oversight in the rule text, but the corrections clearly capture our intent, where our intent with the rule has been all along, and as is reflected in the preamble that was published in the Texas Register. And I'll remind you of those corrections here in a bit. I'll begin with a group of amendments that are intended to increase the odds of early detection and reduce the likelihood of exposing additional deer breeding facilities to CWD. For starters, staff recommend that two tissues be submitted from mortalities that occur, test-eligible mortalities that occur in deer breeding facilities. The current rules require either the OBEX or the medial retropharyngeal lymph node to be sent to the diagnostic lab for testing. But because of differences in the test sensitivity between these two tissues, staff now recommend that both tissues be submitted for testing for deer that, for test-eligible deer that die in these facilities. Staff also recommends shortening the time frame from the death of a breeder deer to reporting that death and submitting those tissue samples to the diagnostic lab from 14 days to 7 days. Also proposed is an increase in the minimum surveillance requirement from 3.6 to 5%, an increase in the requirement for testing eligible mortalities from 80 to 100%, and a reduction in the test eligible age from 16 to 12 months. In addition to achieving our goals of early detection and disease containment, if adopted, these rule amendments would bring our rules in alignment with Texas Animal Health Commission's CWD rules for their herd certification program. Well, following the recommendation of USDA's Center for Epidemiology and Animal Health, we propose to increase the antemortem substitution rate from 3-1 to 5-1. To refresh your memories, what this means is that if a deer breeder fails to submit a not detected test result for a deer that dies, a test eligible deer that dies of natural causes in the facility, then a not detected antemortem test result could be for five deer currently in the facility could be submitted as substitutes. Now, to reiterate a very important point that I shared with you in September and again yesterday, with this substitution, if you will, staff do not intend for anyone to intentionally miss a mortality, to intentionally neglect to test a test-eligible deer that dies in the facility. We intend for 100% of test-eligible deer that die to be tested. But we do recognize that there are some extraordinary circumstances that make this impossible for some. And in those extraordinary circumstances, these antemortem substitutions could be used, these antemortem test results could be substituted for the missing postmortem test results. I'll conclude this by stating that anyone who does intentionally fail to test a mortality in the facility would be in violation of these rules. I'll also state that with this proposal, we have proposed here that the department have the ability to refuse permit renewal to individuals who show a pattern of using these antemortem test results in lieu of postmortem test results. And specifically, staff have proposed that anyone who has to use antemortem substitutions for more than 30% of the test eligible mortalities for more than 2 years would be in jeopardy of not having the permit renewed. Staff also recommend for the test-eligible age for antemortem testing to be 12 months as well, and to limit antemortem testing of a single deer to one time within a 12-month period. Now, currently, a deer cannot be tested more than once within a 24-month period, but we have proposed to reduce that time period to 12 months. And we have a few exceptions to this limitation. Number one, any time that there's a requirement for the whole herd to be tested, well, then obviously deer that were tested within the last 12 months would need to be tested in that case. But we've also proposed exceptions in the event that there aren't enough test-eligible deer available in the facility. And in order to meet the testing quotas, this proposal would allow individuals to test deer that have been tested in the previous 12 months and would even allow individuals to test deer less than 12 months of age, as young as 6 months of age, to help achieve those testing quotas. Now, when whole herd testing is required, the emergency rules that were adopted this past summer allow for up to 10% of the test results to be inconclusive, which typically would be the result of a test sample not having a sufficient number of lymphoid follicles. And we propose to maintain that 10% allowance in these comprehensive rules. And without a doubt, the component of both the emergency rules and these proposed amendments to the comprehensive CWD rules that have received the most opposition is the requirement to antemortem test deer prior to release. Now, it's no secret that staff believe that this is a very important component of this proposal, especially considering that the two index facilities from this past spring were already following all of the proposed amendments that I just shared with you, with one exception, and that is one of those facilities did not submit samples to the lab as timely as we propose here. But despite that, this disease still went undetected in those facilities in the previous years, and at least some experts argue that went undetected longer than that. Antemortem testing prior to release almost certainly would have detected this disease much sooner in both of those facilities. Now, on the previous slide, I shared with you that the proposal, we recommend test eligible age for antemortem testing to be 12 months and older. There is an exception to that, and that is for these deer that are being tested prior to release. We propose to allow deer as young as, to allow deer that are as young as 6 months of age to be antemortem tested when the purpose of that test is liberation. Another measure intended to close some of the CWD surveillance gaps in the program is to consider escapes as mortalities and therefore factored into the equation when determining how many postmortem test results are required for the facility. Something that the CWD task force felt strongly about was limiting the number of breeding facilities that a nursing facility could receive deer from within a single year to one. Commingling deer between facilities has long been a concern of this department, as well as Texas Animal Health Commission. We also recommend to maintain the management strategies for trace and Tier 1 facilities that are currently in the emergency rule. Additionally, we recommend some housekeeping amendments. Most notably would be the deletion of the transfer category or TC statuses for breeding facilities and the comparable statuses for release sites. Now, when we published these proposed amendments, we believed those categories to be obsolete, but we've since realized that that's not a case across the board, which has resulted in our recommendations for some corrections to the proposed text, as we discussed yesterday and will again here in just a bit. Now, moving away from rules pertaining to deer breeding, many stakers have recommended a suspension of the Triple T program until it can be thoroughly evaluated to determine if the program may resume without adding additional risk of disease transmission. In fact, this was a recommendation that was made by 100% of the members of these various advisory committees that we met with. But as I shared with you in September and again yesterday, staff intend for this to be a temporary suspension. We are committed to dive into this with our various advisory committees in the very near future and come back to this commission potentially as early as January, certainly no later than March, with recommendations on how this program may resume without adding that additional any risk to the resource. As we discussed yesterday, staff also proposed to amend the current 5-year prohibition on triple teen deer from breeder deer release sites to state that the sites that have ever received breeder deer would be ineligible as triple T trap sites. Now, I'll come back to this particular proposed amendment when I share public comments with you here in just a bit. Another recommendation that we heard from many stakeholders, which staff agree with, is prohibiting what is commonly referred to as the DMP rent-a-buck program. And what this means is if this is adopted, a breeder deer that is used in a breeding facility would need to be released to the adjacent release site as opposed to be able to transfer back to the originating breeding facility or any breeding facility for that matter. And finally, you're all aware that we do have carcass movement restrictions around the state, and we'd like to encourage similar precautions for hunters throughout the state. And to facilitate this, we have proposed changes to the proof of sex requirements to allow for sex organs accompanied by the tail to serve as proof of sex for does. Finally, as we discussed yesterday, staff recommend proposed amendments be adopted with a few corrections, as we did notice some inadvertent omissions from the proposed text. The elimination of those transfer categories, in particular the TC3 and Class 3 statuses, as part of our housekeeping changes, did create a void in these rules. Now, the preamble does capture our intent with this proposal, but again, there is an inadvertent omission in the proposed text. The recommended adoption includes corrections to address this void. Specifically, the surveillance requirements should apply not only to trace out in Tier 1 facilities, but to trace in facilities as well, and should apply to all sites that are currently classified as Class 3 release sites. The proposal would prohibit the movement of deer from facilities that receive a CWD suspect test result, and it should be clarified to include facilities with a CWD positive test result as well. Now, staff did propose an exception to that prohibition, and we recommend the proposal be amended to allow for herd plans to authorize exceptions as well. And finally, staff would like to clarify that the 30% limit of the use of antemortem test samples as substitute, we'd like to clarify that this does not, it only applies to facilities where mortalities are missed, where test eligible mortalities are not tested, and does not apply to facilities that do test all their mortalities but simply don't have enough mortalities in the facility to meet that 5% minimum testing requirement. That, by the way, is a recommendation we had from some deer breeders. There, believe it or not, a number of deer breeders who actually do support this proposal, and it, almost across the board, there was one concern that they had, and it was with what appeared to be in the rule to not allow somebody who misses, excuse me, who doesn't have enough mortalities to meet that 5% requirement to limit their ability to use antemortem testing for more than 2 years, and that was never the intent. So really good input that we received from breeders, and want to make that clarification today on the record and in the rule. The slide before you addressing public comment is out of date. We ended up with 2,010 comments through the web. I have some other comments I received personally through email. All of the comments through email prior to yesterday, except one, were in support of the proposal. Did receive comments yesterday from Texas Deer Association and Deer Breeders Corporation opposing the proposed amendments. Received comments from a deer breeder yesterday opposing amendments, and then previously received comments from Representative Slayton opposing the amendments. But all other comments I received from several organizations and individuals were in support. Through the web, we received again 2010 comments. We have 60% of those comments agree completely with the proposed changes, 30% disagree completely, 10% disagree specifically on some component. Now, a number of those that in that latter group were not opposed to the proposed enhancements to surveillance requirements for breeding facilities, but were opposed for some other reason. And I'll share some of those comments with you here momentarily. Now, as I shared with you a little bit earlier, the proposed amendment that has received the most opposition has indeed been the requirement to live test or antemortem test deer prior to release. Some outright oppose this requirement. Some oppose it for under specific circumstances, such as when releasing deer to adjacent property under the same ownership, or when the source facility is not a trace or tier one facility, or when the source herd is closed, meaning it hasn't received deer from other facilities for some time, or if the source herd has a certified status in Texas Animal Health Commission's herd certification program. Of course, the two index facilities from this past spring, one in Hunt County, one in Uvalde County, were not considered to be trace or tier one facilities at the time, right? They weren't connected to other positive facilities out there. They had been closed for several years. Both of them have been closed for more than 5 years. And they had either fourth year or certified status in Texas Animal Health Commission's herd certification program. Also, since the emergency rules went into effect, antemortem testing did lead to the discovery of this disease in a seventh deer breeding facility from this spring, a 13th deer breeding facility overall. And that particular deer breeder was preparing to release deer to his own adjacent property. Some have expressed that they need more time to submit samples to the lab and more time to remove CWD-exposed animals from their facility. Some have expressed that 100% testing is overly burdensome and that this requirement, as well as other requirements in the proposal, are too costly. Some have stated that the proposed amendments would have adverse economic impacts, despite what we wrote in the preamble on that. And we've heard this in response to the proposed temporary suspension on Triple T, as well as to the enhanced surveillance requirements for deer breeding facilities. Now, to address this, I'd like to share with you that the Office of the Attorney General has provided guidance to assist state agencies in determining a proposed rule's potential adverse economic effects to small businesses, micro-businesses, or rural economies. Those guidelines state that an agency need only consider a proposed rule's direct adverse economic impacts. TPWD considers direct economic impacts to mean a requirement that would directly impose fees, record-keeping or reporting requirements, result in loss of sales, or require the purchase of equipment or services. The direct adverse impact of the proposed rules on deer breeders are costs associated with increased CWD testing requirements for all deer breeders, increased monitoring requirements for trace and Tier 1 deer breeders, lost sales for deer breeders whose facilities are not movement qualified as a result of the rules, and lost sales for deer breeders that are required to euthanize deer. TPWD did provide estimates for these direct costs. There are no direct adverse impacts of the proposed rules associated with Triple T permits because it is unlawful for a person to receive a direct economic benefit from deer obtained under a Triple T permit. It is a violation for a person to sell or accept anything of value for a deer obtained under a Triple T permit. Now, there have been several who were not, again, I shared with you earlier, who were not necessarily opposed to the enhanced surveillance requirements for breeding facilities, but were opposed for other reasons. One of those was opposition to the proposed suspension of the Triple T program. It's quite clear when reading the comments that there was a thought that we're proposing an elimination of the Triple T program, and as you well know, that's not the case, but rather a temporary suspension until we can address some concerns associated with the risk of transmitting CWD. Some have commented that Triple T should be allowed for breeder deer release sites. Now, since June of 2016, sites that have received breeder deer within the previous 5 years have not been authorized as Triple T sites, Triple T trap sites. Those were intended to be terminal sites because of the CWD risk associated with those sites. This commission recognized in 2016 that while we did not adopt a zero risk policy, the risk associated with the transfer of deer to release sites should not be transferred elsewhere. That five-year period that was included in the rule at that time was part of a negotiated rulemaking process, but as I shared with you yesterday, the science suggests that that risk increases through time beyond that five-year period, leading to this proposed amendment. Nonetheless, staff do recognize the concerns regarding a permanent exclusion of breeder deer release sites as Triple T trap sites. And therefore, we do acknowledge that in the event of a Triple T program suspension, in the event that is adopted, we could consider property-specific analyses to determine whether some breeder deer release sites could be eligible to be Triple T trap sites based on various factors, including the source of the breeder deer, the historical surveillance on the property, et cetera, et cetera. And if this commission requests such, we could return to you with recommendations specific to deer breeder release sites when we return to you to discuss resuming the Triple T program for all other sites. We also received a comment requesting equity in requirements between deer breeding facilities, between the deer breeding and the Triple T programs. Specifically, the Triple T program in the past allowed for transfer of deer between pastures on the same property without CWD surveillance requirements. But breeder deer may not be released to pastures based on this, if this is adopted, would not be able to be released to pastures on the same property without surveillance requirements. To be clear, staff do recommend a temporary suspension of the Triple T program so we can identify and address such shortcomings in the CWD surveillance requirements for that program. Some have also asked why we don't require 100% of deer trapped under a TTP permit to be CWD tested. And the answer is pretty simple. Those who are trapping deer under TTP are not introducing or transporting risk of CWD of CWD transmission. The same is true for MLDP cooperators. And then there were comments that were in opposition to these rules from those who think that the proposal simply didn't go far enough to protect native deer populations from CWD. Some object to the practice of deer breeding. Others don't necessarily object to the practice, but do object to releasing pen-raised deer into free-ranging native populations to commingle with those native deer. Some have recognized that CWD will indeed have adverse economic and ecological impacts in areas where it gets established. And then some have reminded us of our mission statement. They've stated that we're more worried about protecting breeders' business models than we are about protecting the public resource. But obviously, as you all know, we're here before you proposing changes to implement safeguards that are intended to minimize that risk to the public resource. Some have argued that not only should the Triple T program be suspended, but the TTP program be suspended as well. That's the Trap, Transport, and Process program. And some have argued that visible ID should be required for liberated breeder deer. Now, I shared with you earlier who specifically we received, what groups we specifically received opposing comments from. We've also received comments and support from at least 25 different conservation organizations out there. I won't read each of those to you, but I'll just advance to these slides to give you an idea of where some of this support is coming from. With that, Mr. Chairman, staff recommend that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopts new Title 31 of the Texas Administrative Code, Section 65.4, concerning proof of sex for deer, the repeal of Section 65.99, amendments to Section 65.80 through 65.83, 65.88, and 65.90 through 65.98, and new Section 65.99 and 65.100 concerning disease detection and response, and an amendment to Section 65.133 concerning deer management permit, with changes as necessary to the proposed text as published in the October 1, 2021 issue of the Texas Register. And I shared with you those changes that to the proposed text that staff recommend be made. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to entertain any questions that the Commission might have at this time.
Thank you, Mitch. Commissioners, everyone, we have 10 or 12 people that have signed up to speak, and so we'll do that in a second. If any of the commissioners have any questions for Mitch, comments before, we got a few more.
Yes, sir.
If not, we'll start with comments and then circle back. So this won't be your last opportunity. Please, Commissioner Hildebrand.
So, Mitch Hildebrand, Commissioner, have we thought about, there's only one testing facility, and that's at the A&M campus, correct? That is certified under our program.
There's only one facility in the country that is approved by USDA for testing, for diagnostic tests of antemortem testing, not counting the USDA facility in Ames, Iowa, and that's in College Station.
Texas A&M, right. So have we thought about, I mean, there's clearly going to be a crush of testing required under the new proposed program. Have we thought about, can that facility actually handle that level of testing? And if not, what would it take to expand maybe capabilities in the state for another laboratory of that kind?
Excellent question. I appreciate that, Commissioner Hildebrand. That's something we dealt with, we experienced this summer. There certainly was a bottleneck in response to the emergency rule where more than 11,000 deer were antemortem tested within about a 2 to 3 month period, a little bit more than 2 months. And that's the highest volume that lab has dealt with to date. We do not anticipate seeing a similar bottleneck as a result of these rules moving forward. to address that, you may recall the director of the lab sharing with you some of the, back at the previous commission meeting, some of the modifications they made in the lab, both with new equipment and personnel changes to meet those demands. And they just, as we all know, did a phenomenal job meeting those demands. But you might remember there was a really short window to get this testing done between the time that we recognized we were dealing with an emergency and the time that the deadline for releasing bucks for this fall without having to remove antlers. Moving forward in these proposed amendments, we're proposing an extended period of time to achieve antemortem testing, in fact, up to 8 months. And so it's not such a compressed time period, and we do not expect anywhere near the bottleneck that was experienced this summer that the lab was able to address. Having said that, there's always benefit to having more places to test deer, and we recognize that. And really, I don't know a better way of putting it than we're kind of at the mercy of USDA approving. In fact, the lab at Texas A&M University is actually doing this on a exception, if you will. It's an annual approval that they have to go through to get this to deviate from the standard procedures of the National Animal Health Laboratory Network. And so it's, again, something they have to get approved of on an annual basis. But it is my understanding, to wrap this up, it is my understanding that a laboratory in Pennsylvania is seeking authorization to do this as well. And I would anticipate we might see some more labs trickling in with such requests in the future.
Great. I think we need a one at the University of Texas is what I think.
We want these done right.
But I'm not sure how to take that. But I would ask that the staff actually at least monitor this, because what we don't want is a huge delay in the results of this testing. And so if we're going to impose new regulation, then it's our duty to do it in an efficient and effective and streamlined way. Secondly, look forward to your follow-up on Triple T in January of 2022. And third, I would just ask that you look, as your staff looks at the TTT issue, that we think about ways to expand the level of testing in free-ranging deer. I think that's an important element, and I'd like to hear some feedback on that maybe in January. Thank you.
Commissioners, any other questions? And don't forget, we're going to take comments, and now we have more. But anybody want to ask a question of Mitch before we start with public comment? Okay. Mitch, thank you. We're going to hear some comments, but don't leave the room, please. The first requested comment was Ms. Lana Stone. However, Lana called our own Dee Halliburton and said she was going to withdraw her name from the meeting. So I just want to announce that, but she will not be speaking to it. Roy, I see you back there. Roy Leslie is first. Then we'll follow by John True. Hello, John. And then Kevin. And Roy, welcome. And I will encourage everyone to give us their comments, and please keep it to 3 minutes, if you will, Roy. Do we have the lights? Yes, we have the lights.
I'm going to do better than that. I'm going to keep it to 2 minutes.
Thank you, Roy.
Okay. Morning, y'all. I'm Roy Leslie. I'm a low-fence, no-lease landowner in far northwest Kendall County. I represent myself and future generations of land stewards. I'm here in support of the changes. I'm here as I have been since 2015 because I want my 8, 6, and 3-year-old grandkids to know I've done everything I can to protect our wild, free-range, white-tailed deer from a deadly disease. I'm here to remind you, I believe it was brought up a little while ago, about the first 11 words of your mission statement, to manage and conserve the natural and cultural resources of Texas. Nowhere does the Parks and Wildlife mission statement say to protect the animal industry, or to increase the marketability of Texas livestock. Those begin the first two bullet points of the Texas Animal Health Commission's mission statement. Your mission is blurred since chronic wasting appeared in Texas. I know you didn't sign up for this when you accepted a commissioner's role, but here you are in the middle of an existential debate. One side demands you protect a tiny industry, and the other side demands you manage, protect, and conserve a vital natural resource. We're here today because of past compromises made to promote a deeply flawed business model. We're here because of past compromises to increase the marketability of a natural resource for those who do not own the resource. As we've learned from fighting a devastating human disease, initial compromise can have deadly effects. Please don't dilute your biologist's recommendations. I'd like your children and grandchildren also to look back with pride at your efforts in fighting for our wild and free-range white-tailed deer. As in a painfully similar hearing in 2016, I'll withhold my thanks till after the vote. Thanks.
Thank you, Roy. Appreciate you coming. Thank you. John, you're up. Kevin Davis next. Mrs. Dittmar after that. Good morning, John. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you. Chairman Adlin, members of the commission, thank you for the opportunity today. For the record, my name is John True. I'm president of the Texas Deer Association. I've talked several times to you. My position on these proposed rules has not changed. Every business needs rules and regulations, but those rules and regulations need to be clear and they need to be fair. Texas deer breeders are the only entity with mandated CWD testing in Texas. It seems that during this entire process, it's forgotten, and we get no credit for the thousands of postmortem testing samples that every single breeder does every single year. These proposed rules continue to be targeted solely at our industry, and it's not right. We've lost 112 breeders since the emergency rules went into effect in June. We've continued to step up to the plate when asked to get creative on what we could live with, and it continues to get us nowhere. I can stand in front of you today knowing that we tried everything we could using reason, logic, and science to try to figure out a set of rules that all parties could live with. At the end of the day, we're not looking for any favors. We just want to be treated fairly. That's all I have. Thank you.
John, thank you for coming. Thank you very much. Kevin Davis. Kevin, how are you? Ms. Dittmar, and then Don Steinbach following up.
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name's Kevin Davis, here representing Deer Breeders Association Corporation and myself. We do still oppose these rules. My former colleague Mitch Lockwood mentioned this morning, our aversion is mostly dealing with the 100% live testing requirement prior to release. As you've heard me say before this summer, it costs a pile of money to do that, and it is extremely hard on staff, and it's very, very expensive. $3.6 million spent this summer on over 12,000 live tests with zero detections under the release program of CWD detection. Now, my former colleague this morning testified that antemortem testing did catch another facility, caught another animal, and he is correct in that. However, that animal was being tested under the routine surveillance program that already exists, meaning that that program worked as intended. We are certainly fans of all tools of CWD management and all tools of intensive management of deer. We don't quite understand the proposal before us today on the Triple T secession for a time period. We see that as a chance to provide surveillance, meaning that they have to test 15 animals prior to them moving deer. We would suggest an amendment to the rules in an effort to keep that program going, and that would be that we would test 100% of our intended animals to be released up to 15 animals. And given the increased surveillance that we've already supported in the in the pen with 100% testing mortalities and the decreased time frame in submission of a test. We feel like that would provide an avenue for all parties to have a little bit of skin in the game. It would also more evenly spread out the cost of testing across all breeders. With that, I'll answer any questions you have.
Kevin, thank you. Appreciate you coming as always. Thank you very much for your words. Ms. Dittmar, there she is. Don Steinbach next, then Jonathan Letts. How are you, ma'am?
I'm good, thank you.
Welcome.
I am the widow of Dr. Bob Dittmar, and I don't have it written down today. It's coming from my heart. I completely support Texas Parks and Wildlife in their efforts to protect our native deer herd. My least favorite words in the English language is would've, could've, should've. I wish I had listened more to Bob's words about chronic wasting disease. I could speak more eloquently of that. I am passionate about our native deer herd. Yesterday, our son and I took feed out to our Squaw Creek Ranch at Doss. And on the way home, I almost murdered two giant bucks who were strutting across the road, could care less about this vehicle coming at 60 miles an hour. And I remembered the rut. Bob and I loved the rut of the native deer herd. I am so incredibly proud of his work that he did, and I'm incredibly proud of my granddaughter, Hayden, age 11, Paige, age 8, Kimber, age 8, and our sweet little Levi, age 5, who can't wait to kill his first deer. They know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that their papa is going to be instrumental in protecting this native deer herd. And my question to you is this. Are you going to say woulda, coulda, shoulda? And what are you going to tell your grandchildren and their great-grandchildren? And I thank you for this opportunity.
Mrs. Dittmar, thank you for coming. We all miss Dr. Bob. I know not like you do, but he did so many things for this state and for the resource and for this agency. Just a prince of a man.
Thank you.
I know it wasn't easy for you to come up here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck following that one. Don Steinbach, Jonathan Letts, then Sarah Biden-Harn, if I got that correct. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, sir. Thank you. For the record, my name is Don Steinbach. I'm the executive director of the Texas chapter of the Wildlife Society. CWD, as you are aware, is a very serious disease affecting several species of cervids. We commend the TPWD Commission for considering adoption of these emergency rules to protect the wild deer herd of Texas and preserving the deer hunting heritage of Texas hunters and the valuable assets utilized by landowning community that depend on the lease hunting system. The movement of deer has allowed for the transmission of the disease across a broad landscape in Texas. We therefore advocate for the testing of all the proof of negative tests for CWD before movement is permitted. These deer should have an easily identifiable tag that can be seen from a distance to allow for the removal of deer that epidemiology determines provide a risk to wild deer. The importance of deer hunting to perpetuate the conservation of wildlife resources in Texas is imperative for the continued hunting traditions and the funding mechanisms for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Agency. The public of Texas would expect the TPWD to exercise these utmost care to protect the public trust resources that are cherished by the Texas citizens and we therefore ask you to adopt these rules. Be glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Don. Thank you for coming, and appreciate your words.
Yes, sir.
Jonathan, Sarah, then Jeff Jones. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners, staff. My name is Jonathan Less. I'm Vice President of the Texas Wildlife Association. I'm a landowner, a rancher, and a business owner in Kerr County. My family purchased our ranch 85 years ago, and my grandfather started leasing the property for whitetail hunting in 1937. Deer hunting has been a part of my family's heritage, and leasing our ranch for deer hunting has been an integral part of our financial income since 1937. Our family situation is no different than thousands of other families across this great state. The perspective I want to discuss today is that of a neighboring landowner. My ranch and the majority of ranches in Texas are low-fenced. Deer move freely across property lines. As a landowner, one of the things that concerns me most is the inability to determine if a deer on my ranch has been released after being transported from a deer breeding facility and then escaped into the wild. High fences can be damaged by floods, hogs, fallen trees, broken limbs, ice storms, and many other factors. Deer do and will escape from high fence properties. Countless hunters and landowners are left vulnerable when deer are released into the wild without a CWD test or identification. The ability now exists for live testing, and this can help prevent the possibility of an infected animal coming onto neighboring properties and causing damage to the wild deer population and private property owners. The importance of visible ear tags on all released deer is critical as we move forward. This issue must be addressed, and while this is likely a legislative issue, I urge the Commission to do everything possible to support visible ear tags. Landowners and hunters must be able to tell if a deer on their property is a released deer. It is so important that we and you do what we can to stop the spread of this disease. I urge you to adopt the proposed rules today to help slow the spread of CWD. And finally, I'd like to thank the commission and staff and many in the room for the thousands of hours that have been spent on this issue. It's very appreciative. Thank you all.
Thank you, John. Okay. Thank you for coming. Sarah Bidenhorn. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning. Chairman Applin, Commissioners, Mr. Smith, good morning, and thank you for your continued commitment to this important issue. I am Sarah Bidenhorn, President of Texas Wildlife Association. Our membership is comprised of landowners, hunters, and outdoor enthusiasts who care deeply about issues facing private lands and the management of our state's natural resources. Today, I represent all of those members, many of whom have joined me here in person this morning, when I say that our organization supports the proposed rules for the management of chronic wasting disease. We have heard many times over the past few weeks about the economic concerns from those that will be directly impacted by the new rules. And while those concerns may be valid, they must be balanced by the concerns of the much larger number who stand to be affected by the continued spread of the disease. With just 850 registered deer breeders and 70,000 captive deer, the deer breeding industry makes up a very small piece of the overall hunting economy in Texas. The decisions made today will impact the health of the state's 5.4 million wild deer that are cared for and relied on by 1.3 million hunters and over 250,000 landowners. Not to mention the many generations of hunters and landowners who will likely experience the bulk of the consequences from further spread of the disease. CWD threatens the future of hunting for all Texans and will burden thousands of hunting-related businesses, which will consequently impact many rural economies. I'm a landowner and rancher myself and know firsthand the importance of hunting-related income. It is very often the only line item that can be relied on from year to year and normally makes up a large percentage of the overall revenues. I also grew up in a small town where everything from the feed store to the Dairy Queen relied on the influx of hunters every November. Suffice it to say, there are many Texans that will be harmed by the continued spread of CWD. I urge the Commission to pass the proposed rules today in order to help protect all Texans, present and future. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you
very much. Jeff Jones, Judy Logan, Jim Taylor, Justin. Jeff, you're up. Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner. Commission, thank you for letting me speak this morning. I drove in here from the ranch last night. It's pretty late, so I didn't get to write anything down. So I'm just going to vent a little bit here, and I don't want to offend any of you, but I'm going to say what's on my mind. I've been breeding deer for over 20 years. Really, to be honest with you, I think I'm coming on my 24th year. Never had a violation. Never had an escaped deer. And certainly never had CWD. Don't want it. Every time we come up here, we hear the same thing. We hear Roy say, well, you know, those breeders don't own those deer. Okay, y'all own them. Let me give you some back. You don't want them back. You want to say you own them, but you don't want them back. Very confusing. I hear Miss Dittmeyer say, it's all about protecting the wild. I totally agree. Why aren't we testing the wild? You brought that up yourself a while ago. 5.4 million. Look how many wild tests have been tested. And then look what you're doing to the deer breeders. 100% on deer breeders and a grain of salt in the wild. You're not protecting the wild. You're just talking like you are. That's what you're doing. Now we're down to the point with this set of rules where a while ago, when everybody had to fight and the people wanted to own the deer, they aren't the deer breeders' deer, and people want to own them, well, now you own them. But what the Supreme Court did say is that the people own them. I'm glad they said that, because that pretty much tells me that I own deer in the wild, and I demand that the wild be tested. The people should be testing the deer in the wild, whether you want to or not. If you test the wild, you will find chronic waste disease. And then one thing I want to put on every one of y'all, don't you think about this. This testing before we release to our private properties, our fence, high fence, you're wanting us to test, is that not a private property issue? Now this commission is going to come in and tell us what we can do on our private property. We're not breaking the law. We're paying our taxes. Now y'all want to come inside our high fence and tell us what to do? It's a total disgrace. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jeff. Judy Logan, Jim Taylor like to visit, speak together, then Justin, then Marco. Can't see if that says Barrett, but Marco. Good morning, Judy and Jim.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're Judy Logan and Jim Taylor, with 57 years of service as Texas public school educators. We're the owners of Texas Whitetail Deer of Texas. Parks and Wildlife has shared data that shows that 90 deer need to be sampled for an infinite size herd. I believe you have a handout. Our numbers are highlighted in green. Since starting our deer breeding operation in 2006, we have had 1,095 adult deer in our pens. To date, we have submitted 135 postmortem tests and 70 antimortem tests, with the exception of 5 animals in our pens. All of our deer were born and raised on a ranch. We have a closed herd and are fully certified by Animal Health. Based on summer testing, we have calculated that it will cost us approximately $74,000 to test our herd under the proposed rules. Most of those deer in our herd will be released onto our own high fence property simply by opening a gate and letting them walk out onto our high fence property. We truly feel that the continued testing will prove to be a waste of hard-earned dollars. However, it's not the money that concerns us. Instead, it is the undaunting and needless task of cutting a chunk of flesh out of a live animal's anus. In July, or since July, we have lost 3 bucks due to sedation. Our oldest doe is 17 years old, and we can't stand the thought of cutting her in order to let her walk out onto our property. We absolutely love our deer and our operation, but due to antemortem requirements, we are closing our deer breeding operation. We've talked to Parks and Wildlife on several occasions. We want to work together. The rules simply need to be manageable and truly needed. Based on our data, we ask, why must we continue to test every deer in our pens? The corrective actions taken last March addressed sufficient surveillance for most breeders. We appreciate your time, and we would like to publicly thank John True and Kevin Davis for all that they have done for breeders over the last many months. Thank you.
Rudy, thank you.
Thank you.
Justin, Marco, then Brian. Good morning, Justin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Justin Drivalbliss. I'm the CEO at Texas Wildlife Association. Very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this morning. You've heard our position on the proposed rules. We are in support. I just briefly want to touch on a couple of items within the proposed rule package that we feel like are important. There's a lot of things we don't know about CWD. That's frustrating to all of us, I know. But there are some things that we do know, and one of them is that moving live CWD-susceptible animals around the state in an unnatural way, up and down the highway, greatly increases our risk of spreading the disease. So with that in mind, we strongly recommend 100% antemortem testing of every breeder deer to be released. We know that live testing has been a great technological advancement for the industry and for disease management, but we also know that it's not perfect. And then it's not 100% detectability, so we feel like testing any less than 100% is irresponsible. Also wanted to touch briefly on Triple T. TWA does support a temporary pause on Triple T, and I do want to emphasize the word temporary. Very much appreciate the conversation yesterday and today about a follow-up schedule on when Mitch and his team will come back in January or at the latest March to follow up on that. Our organization does see a lot of value in that permit, and we hope and expect that it'll be back soon. Just in closing, CWD is a real threat to our rural economies, our private working lands, and the future of hunting, so we appreciate the seriousness with which this commission is taking it, and we're here to help any way we can. Thanks.
Justin, thank you. Marco, then Brian, followed by Matt Wagner. Hello, Marco. Welcome.
Good morning. On a cold November morning, hopefully we have a good start to deer season here in a couple of days. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Marco Barrett. I'm past president of Texas Wildlife Association and the current chair of the organization's Big Game Committee. As a hunter, landowner, and small business owner, I'm deeply concerned about the recent detection of chronic wasting disease in 7 white-tailed deer breeding facilities across the state of Texas. From what we understand, there are several ways the CWD could possibly be spread, but by far the greatest risk of spreading the disease is via the human movement of live animals. What does a Texas look like with CWD common on the landscape? What does it mean for our hunting tradition, land value, local rural economies, and most importantly, to the wildlife itself? There are studies and models that indicate CWD will have population-level impacts that reduce the total numbers of deer, and in doing so, compress the age structure of the deer herd, making it harder for animals to get to maturity should the infection rate be high enough. My management plan on my ranch is geared towards the harvest of mature animals beginning at 6 years old. It's already tough enough for a deer to get to 6 or 7 in the South Texas brush country. We don't need it to be any harder. In addition to the direct impacts that CWD could have to the deer herd, what are the effects on the hunting community? Hunters hunt for a lot of reasons, but the first reason almost every hunter mentions is meat. Since 1997, the World Health Organization has recommended that it is important to keep agents of all known prion diseases from entering the human food chain. I know that we have never found a proven case of CWD crossing the species barrier from deer to humans like we have with BSE between humans and cattle. But I know I'll worry about feeding deer meat to my kids if CWD is found near our property. For the sake of all landowners, wildlife enthusiasts, and hunters, please implement these strong rules, science-based rules, to help stop the spread of the disease. Appreciate you.
Marco, thank you. Brian, followed by Matt. Morning, Brian.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your time on this important topic, and thank you for the time to speak to you. I'm here representing myself. My name is Brian Hashke, for the record, and my family partnership. We have been caring for our family holdings in Gillespie County for now six generations. We've continuously owned these properties since the 1850s, 1860s. I'm a lifelong hunter and outdoorsman. I harvest white-tailed deer, other wild game each year. I feed it to my family and friends. As a landowner, we rely on the income from our hunting leases to help maintain these holdings. We operate under low fence. We manage our pastures for both beef cattle and for wildlife management. We actively participate in our community wildlife management associations, and I'm a member of the Texas Wildlife Association. We have hunting logs. We've got reports from Parks and Wildlife. We have improved our deer herd over the years through our management techniques. We want to protect and continue to do so. We've been collecting samples on our harvested animals over the last 3 years. I had the pleasure of calling our past state veterinarian my uncle. So we had a pretty active surveillance on our property in our native herd. We probably collected close to 100% of samples of all harvested animals, both managed game and non-native species, cervids, at-risk population. We've yet to detect CWD in our native population. We hope to keep it that way. In regards to the risk, I look at that map of positive facilities. That circle is closing on our family holdings. It's getting closer. I've got a pasture full of exotics. These are not native species. These are animals that have inadvertently spread. Clearly the risk is there. The increasing risk of CWD is closing in on us. We are in support of the proposed rules that Mr. Lockwood is bringing forward to you. Thank you for your time.
Brian, thank you for coming. Matt Wagner, then John Shepherd, then Grant Everett. Good morning, Matt.
Morning. Greetings, Chairman Applin, Commissioners. My name is Matt Wagner. I'm the past president of the Texas Chapter of the Wildlife Society and certified wildlife biologist. I also teach wildlife law and policy at Texas State University. I consult on private ranches in Central Texas. It's hard to believe, but I retired 5 years ago from this wonderful agency. I'm in support of the proposed rules concerning CWD. TPWD's mission is to conserve our natural resources, and in this case, our white-tailed deer population and all the landowners, hunters, and other stakeholders that rely on a healthy economy and environment. In my class, we study the public-private partnerships that we enjoy in this state. The lease hunting model, the oyster fishery lease model, wildlife cooperatives on private land, and the myriad of permit programs that allow tremendous flexibility for the private sector to engage in all sorts of activities with our public resources. But today we're realizing the unintended consequences of another public-private partnership, the deer breeding industry. Like Mitch Lockwood said yesterday, the department is caught between two opposing forces. Following the evolving science of CWD management and accommodating the needs of deer breeding as an economic enterprise for a relatively small number of operators. How much risk is the department willing to gamble with our deer herds, deer hunters, landowners, and a $2 billion hunting economy? And it hasn't been talked about much, but the department spends over $1.5 million a year to manage permitted deer breeders and CWD. Who pays for that? Where do these dollars come from? Hunters. How do they feel about deer breeding in Texas? Why don't we ask them? I'm sure they would much rather see those dollars spent on what they were intended for, the stewardship of all wildlife and wildlife habitat, and more access to hunting on public and private land. Thank you for this opportunity to make comments.
Thank you, Matt. John. Hello, John. Then Grant. then Rodney. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission. My name is John Shepherd. I'm the Executive Director of the Texas Foundation for Conservation, and I'm here to testify in support of the proposed rules today. I do want to focus my comments on the letter that was signed by 25 organizations. The South Texans Property Rights Association was a late signer. You can see that these organizations represent a wide spectrum across the conservation community. And it's not often we can get Safari Club International and Sierra Club to sign the same letter, but we did today. These organizations represent over 100,000 Texans who are voicing their support today for these proposed rules. The message is clear. We don't want to see the spread of CWD across Texas, and we need to have stringent safeguards in place to protect from that. We have an obligation to protect our fish and wildlife resources for future generations of Texans so that they can enjoy them as we do today. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. Grant, followed by Rodney, then Catherine Romans. Good morning, Grant. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm one of the evil deer breeders, based on the comments. Woo. My name is Grant Everidge, and I'm asking Texas Parks and Wildlife to stop requiring deer breeders to live test deer before they're released into the wild. The live tests are a huge financial burden on my farm and possibly will result in me closing my breeding operation. Recently, I live tested 16 deer that I'll sell in the future. Haven't sold them all. And the cost of testing those 16 deer were $5,795, and I have the bills over there. When it comes to selling deer, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know when someone's going to come to my ranch, buy deer or not, or which one they're going to buy. I have 89 adult deer in my pens, and according to the rules now, to release any of them, I got to test them. So if I tested all 89 deer, that cost $32,000 based on the bills that I presented y'all. So I am at, and there's no guarantee, if I tested them, there's no guarantee I'm going to sell one deer. That's $32,000 and no guarantee of getting anything back. So I'm asking Texas Parks and Wildlife to let the rules that they put in effect, I believe it's March, let that see if it'll work instead of making these emergency rules permanent. Now, of course, with my crystal ball and not knowing when someone's going to buy a deer, someone came to my ranch, wanted to buy a buck for a DMP pen recently, was not tested. I said, okay, I'll call my vet that charged me $5,795 to test 16 deer. He came up, tested a deer. I mean, like 2 days later, another guy came up, and bought another DMP pen, another DMP pen. Called him up, would you test this deer? He came up. I got the bill last night, and I don't have a copy for it, but I'll make it. One bill was $1,200 to test one deer. The other deer was $1,100 to test one deer. You know, if we go through with these rules, I mean, it's happening. We will be out of business. You know, on Ms. Betmore, she eloquently stated about her grandkids and this and this. Well, what about my grandkids? My grandkids want to raise deer, too. Do they not count? Thank you.
Thank you, Grant. Rodney, Catherine, then Tim.
Thank y'all for letting me speak.
Good morning, Rod.
I'm a deer breeder. I've been breeding deer for over 20 years. I'm a deer lover. I've got high fence for 40 years, and I've got low fence. My family's been in Hamilton County over 100 years, same land. And I'm opposed to these new rules, especially the one releasing deer into adjacent property. My deer pens are here. My high fence is here. It's been fenced for 40 years. Those deer can sniff each other. They can spread the disease. Why am I having to test a deer that's in contact if I had chronic wasting disease in my pens? It makes no sense to me. That's like me having to pay to test my cows for for mad cow disease to move them from one pasture to the next. This disease is a bad disease. Nobody loves deer any more than I do. Wild deer, I've got low fence, I've got high fence. But I am being subjected to costs that I can't afford. I don't sell just a handful of deer over the 20 years. It's for my hunting operation under the high fence. And I spent $1,100 or $1,200 to test four deer the other day so I could be movement qualified, so I could release my pen raised deer into my high fence. This isn't fair. Not any part of that. I wish that y'all would consider not adopting these rules until you've looked at people like me. I'm not retired. I'm an ex-dairyman. I'm a cattle rancher. I'm a deer breeder. I raise bucking bulls. I do anything I can to make a living. I put in 12 hours yesterday. I don't hire anybody, but I dang sure can't afford to play y'all's game testing all my deer to release them just through a net wire fence. I appreciate your time.
Rodney, thank you. Catherine Romans.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, commissioners. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Catherine Romans, and I'm the executive director of the Hill Country Alliance. I was here before you at your August meeting and wanted to come once again to speak about the very important issue of chronic wasting disease. The Hill Country Alliance works across 17 counties of Central Texas with thousands of landowners, residents, visitors, local leaders and elected officials, hunters, anglers, swimmers, and lovers of this region as our partners. Those partners are as diverse as the region and the issues we work on, but they are unified by a common interest to work proactively to protect the defining natural resources of the Hill Country, the lands, the waters, the communities, the night skies, and the wildlife that call this place home. I am here today to urge you to adopt the staff proposed rules as they are amended today. As you all know, the Hill Country is growing quickly. As land values skyrocket, leasing hunting access is increasingly an invaluable tool for landowners needing to create a source of income to sustain their land ownership. Chronic wasting disease is an existential threat to those landowners and the wider landscape of native deer and ecological function of our region. The rules proposed are an important step to ensuring both the economic and ecological health of our region and the rest of the state. I thank you for all you do to protect Texas and our wild places. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine. Tim, then Stephen Bender. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I represent a huge portion of the deer breeders in the state of Texas at their request. 6.5 years ago, I came to this department, and I sat down with Carter Smith, Clayton Wolf, and Kevin Davis, and I expressed my willingness to come to Texas and help build a relationship between this agency and the deer breeders to get everybody to get along better and be able to work together for common sense rules and regulations that work for everybody, including this department. I also met with the representatives of TWA and expressed my concern with being able to work with them as well. I also talked about all the things that we had in common, the things that we should be fighting for together, things like the Second Amendment right, bringing children into hunting, protecting our private property rights, and protecting the hunting heritage of the state of Texas. I came to work together with everybody to build relationships where we could do everything that we wanted to do and do it together. Over time, that worked. 6.5 years ago, we worked on a set of rules in 2016 that we put together that worked. They worked. Every single time they worked, except for one thing that we missed. We didn't do a 7-day test submission on our samples. If we had, we wouldn't be sitting in here today talking about emergency rules that's put 100-something people out of business. Doesn't matter if it's only 100-something people, unless it happens to be your mom or your dad or your brother or sister or you. But then it matters, and it matters a lot. And I can tell you the rules that you are trying to put in place right now remind me that I feel like I'm sitting in Minnesota or Wisconsin or New York City. These rules are so liberal that I can't believe that I'm sitting up here. We are all, every one of us in this room, love wildlife and we love deer. And we're all trying to protect them. We're doing way more in our part. We hear about that we have a 99.1 confidence rate of finding a disease in a place if it exists. We've only found it once through normal surveillance in the state of Texas. So I would say we have a 20% chance of finding it at a 1% infection rate. If you will go test your deer across the state, we have hundreds of square miles in several different areas where there has never been a test performed. How do you know you don't have CWD? You have CWD in a lot of locations in the state, and to cherry pick research to bring to y'all, I would love to send y'all research, that's actual research, that we could all point to and say it actually has worked. But to sit and cherry pick research to push your agenda, and that agenda now appears to me that what I done 6.5 years ago when I come down here and busted my hump, and I paid a high personal price for doing so with my peers. But I done it anyway because you know why? It was the right thing to do. And today the right thing to do is laying on your plate. And as a public citizen, I expect people in your positions to do the right thing. It's not complicated. The people in the state of Texas do have a right to know. But you know what? Regardless of what happens, you can't put up 20 fences or 100 fences and stop CWD. Crows, dust, plant material takes it up. Everything that's being sent across this country, compost and everything else. The good news is it's showing in Wyoming, Colorado, and Wisconsin that the deer are morphing into being-resistant animals. Okay, we have even better news. With Chris Seabury's research, it's proven that we are going to be able to breed our way out of this. We want to work together with y'all to help do that. But since 2016, everything was great. The people here worked with me and everything else. 2021, I don't know what happened. But no one wants to work together anymore. Please change that. If nothing else, put a hold on stuff until we get the correct information out here. Because the stuff in this room that people are hearing is not really totally accurate. And I appreciate you guys letting me talk. And I hope that you understand this is passion. Because I love deer, too. And so does everyone in my family. Thank you.
Jim. Stephen Bender.
Good morning, Chairman Applin and Commission. We'll see how this goes. I forgot to bring my glasses in. So we'll take a minute and do a little trombone here, figure out if I can read this or not. My name is Steve Bender. I'm with the National Wildlife Federation. We are supportive of the updates that Texas Parks and Wildlife Department biologists are recommending to the Commission concerning chronic wasting disease detection and response. NWF is always supportive of science-based management of wildlife and habitat. Having been a staff member of the Wildlife Division here at Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, I have always been impressed with the intelligent and talented team of biologists that are part of this effort. Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's thoughtful and science-focused approach is critical to proper management of all species. As a hunter, I want to ensure that the population of deer and other huntable species are healthy. Chronic wasting disease looms over many states and in some cases is an epidemic. Texas has been able to, through good planning, swift action, and proper regulation, manage smaller outbreaks and keep white-tailed deer and other cervid species populations relatively safe from the disease. Ultimately, we must minimize the threat of CWD in the wild deer population in Texas. Thoughtful action is required, and I believe that with these proposed amendments to the CWD rules, TPWD is stepping up to that challenge. Thank you.
Stephen, thank you. All right. That's all I have on people that have submitted that they would like to comment. Dee, is that correct? I want to thank everybody for taking the effort to come here in person and to make their comments to the full commission. I want to thank y'all for the effort that you put forward on that. Okay, commissioners, I'm going to open it back up for conversations, comments, statements, anything you want to do, and we'll bring Mitch or staff or anybody else back up if you have a question for him now that we've heard comments from the public. So, commissioners, it's open to you.
Mr. Chairman and fellow commissioners, after listening to all of the comments, both pro and con and everything, I know we all care a great deal on both sides of this issue. It's a very difficult position that we find ourselves in. One thing that does stick out in my mind, however we go on these rules and stuff, there's not any provision for this ending at any point in time. At the very least, I would suggest and make a motion that we put a 3-year sunset at least on the antemortem testing only. That way there is a limit and there is a cutoff point. That's my suggestion.
Thank you, Dick. That plays in a little bit what Commissioner Hildebrand mentioned yesterday about, you know, these things having an end. Before we ask for a motion, Dick, thank you for that. I know you offered, but I want to make sure anybody else has any questions, comments, statements, in specific, in general, whatever.
Mr. Chairman, I had one question I'd like to ask for. Mitch, if you could come back to the podium for just a second. If you could help me just understand a little bit more when we talk about the limitation on movement, and there was and I know we've read about it and the comment made about releasing a deer onto your own high fence property next door. Can you help me understand a little bit more, either the risk there? I mean, on one hand, it seems like it would be limited. On the other hand, I understand when you're transferring an animal from one segment of a property to another, but if it's still on the same property, how do we assess that risk?
Well, when you say how do we assess the risk, is the question more of the need for antemortem testing when releasing to adjacent property?
I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, I guess that's the fair way of saying it. If the property is contiguous, right, and so it all belongs to the same person. I do understand that we've moved from this space to this space, and maybe when we were in this space, there was more. You couldn't get to this outer limit, right? But what's the greater risk when we did that expansion? Because maybe I'm thinking on one hand, and I'm trying to play devil's advocate. If it's on my property and I'm still managing things, have I really increased the risk? Other than keeping it in that smaller circle?
So, good question, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment on that. I mean, when you say keeping it in there, you know, for how long? How long is that deer going to remain within that property? We know that deer do get out of breeding facilities. We know that deer don't stay on the same properties. Whether water gaps wash out, deer jump fences, or other reasons, we know they don't. And the farther removed they are from a captive facility, the more they do put at risk neighboring properties, neighboring deer populations. Another concern that we have is that a disease is number one, it's more easily contained in a captive facility, but number two, it's more easily detected in the first place in a captive facility. And much more difficult, as some have commented today, much more difficult to detect when it's in, I'll say, free-ranging populations, where you're not testing all mortalities that occur, or even maybe any mortalities that occur within that property. And so the risk of containing that, the ability to contain that disease gets much more difficult the further we remove the deer from the captive setting. And so it's, with that in mind, just keep in mind, if you will, please, the, let's think about these facilities where CWD has been detected. We heard some really good comments today, and some facilities that one in particular I think is a model facility for deer breeders in this state. But, you know, we have one of these positive, well, actually, as I shared with you, both of the what we call the index facilities that hadn't introduced deer for a number of years, had been testing a very high number of mortalities for many years, and so on. Facilities where we really, there's a lot of people scratching their head over how these facilities got the disease, but they did. And obviously, in one of those cases, releases deer to their own property. And as those deer remove from the pen to their property, again, as I stated, it then begins to put neighboring properties and neighboring populations at higher risk.
Mr. Chairman, Hildebrand, just a couple of things, Mitch. One is I sincerely want you to follow up in terms of monitoring how long these tests are in the queue at the A&M laboratory, because what I don't want to do is put this huge burden from a timing standpoint on people that are conducting the testing. So I'd really like a follow-up on that and a monitoring that those tests are being performed quickly and efficiently. So that's one. Two, I continue to say, I mean, there were some very nice comments on both sides of the table today, and I see both sides' points, but we must continue and expand a testing program for free-ranging deer, because what I love the commissioner's request for sunset on 3 years, but we need to have some benchmarks in order to determine, is the situation getting better or worse? And those need to be quantitative benchmarks. And so I'd really like to ask the commission to think about a program that is systematic, that we relook at every quarter, every year, to determine, is the situation getting better or worse? And not just qualitative comment on, well, we have another deer breeding facility that's got CWD. So those are my comments.
Thank you, Commissioner. On your first point, you might recall that the director of the lab reported to this commission that during that peak bottleneck period, they maintained an average of about a 21-day turnaround time on getting results back to their customers. You heard testimony from an individual who was not within that average. He was more at the, I think, 28, 29-day turnaround, but that was certainly an exception. Outside of the bottleneck, you're looking at, it's pretty common, it's very common for these results to be returned in less than a two-week period. And I'll tell you this, last year when we submitted many of the samples that we submit, we were at, for 100 harvest samples, we were at about a three-day turnaround. And I think that's a pretty good transition to your other point. Well, we've talked quite a bit about our surveillance program, and it's become increasingly obvious to me that staff has done a very poor job of conveying to you really what our surveillance program entails and how strong it is, especially when I hear some of the comments this morning about we need to test wild deer. We do test wild deer. We test lots of free-ranging deer. You might remember from Ryan Shaney's presentation, we've established a great deal of confidence that we would detect this disease if it occurred at a low prevalence in the vast majority of the state with our existing program that was enhanced greatly in 2016 and then again in 2019 and 2020 as we continue to make increases. A common model that a lot of people use is try to detect a certain degree of confidence. A lot of people strive for 95%, some strive for 99% to detect this disease at a 5% prevalence. Well, if we've got 5.4 million deer in the state and we have 5% prevalence of this disease throughout the state, I believe that comes out to 270,000 positive animals. We would be finding lots of CWD with our surveillance program that we currently have if we had a 5% prevalence throughout this state. Now, you've heard me say before, this is a focal disease. We're not going to have this disease evenly distributed across the landscape. So surveillance is important, and we recognize that. And I will tell you that these samples, these 67,000 samples we collect over the last few years, and that's just over the last 5 years, not looking further back in the history and what we've collected in previous years prior to that. But when you look at this, we do realize that we have properties in this state that are high-fence properties, independent populations, that haven't contributed to this effort. We realize the disease could be on some of those properties, and it's undetected because they haven't contributed. And what we believe, as I shared with you before, is we really should shift our focus to look at some of these gaps where we have less surveillance. But if we do that, you realize that's going to result in a reduction in total number of samples collected, because we can collect a whole lot more samples at a locker plant or a meat processing facility than we're going to get from an individual high-fence ranch to try and fill in the gaps. And so we do kind of have a conflict of interest here, I mean, within our staff, trying to determine how we achieve these overall goals and increase number of samples more and more and more, but also try and fill in these gaps where we have. So it's, I think I'd just like to sum it up by saying perhaps would appreciate another opportunity at some point to maybe do a better job than we've done in the past, getting you better informed of what our surveillance program really looks like, and how much confidence that we do have that we would detect this disease where it exists in the state. Because it's clearly a far better surveillance program than what some of our constituents out there realize that it is. And we need to make that part of our education campaign that you've heard me talk about, this Got Milk campaign that we want to embark on. We need to make it part of that campaign so Texans know how strong our surveillance program really is.
Patton, I've got a question. You know, personally, do you think these measures today that were taken, or I anticipate are going to be taken, are actually going to do away with CWD?
I do not think these actions will do away with CWD in the state of Texas. I do think they are very strong measures to try and help reduce the likelihood of transmitting this disease to more facilities, as we saw happen in this past year. You heard a previous commenter talk about we wouldn't be here today if we had this 7-day requirement to submit into the samples to the lab. Well, while that's not true, it is true that there are 4 facilities of the 7 that potentially very, very likely would not have gotten the disease if we had that requirement. But there's 3 others that they could have reported them the second and turned in the sample the second that the deer died, and it wouldn't have prevented that. And so the disease has been transferred to other facilities, and these rules are designed to prevent that or greatly reduce the likelihood of that happening. So it won't eliminate CWD from the state of Texas, but hopefully it'll go a long way to keep more deer breeders in this state. Let me phrase that the right way, to make sure that other deer breeders in the state do not get exposed to this disease.
You know, one of the things that has troubled me from the, say, the workshop to the last scheduled meeting was, even with the antemortem testing, I think it was you that said the results of the antemortem test are only as good as the test or sample that was taken that day. Is that a correct
statement? That was a statement made by one of our constituents out there. I certainly do not agree with that statement. We have a proposal before you to allow for antemortem samples to be collected as much as 8 months prior to the release of the deer, not the same day as the release of the deer. So I do not agree with that statement, but you have heard me say that antemortem tests do miss positives. In fact, there's a concerning proportion of positive animals that a rectal biopsy is not going to detect, but it does still provide us a whole lot better confidence that deer don't have the disease than no test at all. But you've heard us say it's really most valuable as a herd screening tool as opposed to an individual animal surveillance tool, if you will, to to say this animal doesn't have the disease. It's not very good at that, but it is very good at saying this herd is likely, there's a low probability of this CWD being in this particular herd. And so when you release in deer prior to release, you're getting that better, broader surveillance for the herd to provide that confidence.
Well, I think that's exactly what the deer breeders, or several of them, have the position they've taken, that they certainly want to continue antemortem testing. They believe in antemortem testing, but just not test every single deer that gets transferred. And it sounds like you agree with that, but you still want every single deer that gets transferred to have an antemortem test.
I'm sorry for leaving that impression. I do not agree with that. I very much, along with all staff, very much believe that antemortem testing of all deer prior to release is critical to try to protect. You heard me a minute ago say other deer breeders from this disease, but in this case, protect our native populations from this disease. I think it's critical. It can miss it. It could miss it, but we're definitely going to miss it where it exists, where we're not testing prior to release.
You know, one of the speakers made a comment, I think it was the vice president in the back, that ultimately this may be a legislative issue. Because do you agree with that or not, or do you think that we keep it in this department issue?
What that speaker was referring to was a requirement for maintaining visible ID upon release. I think it's safe to say that a statutory change would be necessary. I know there's different thoughts on that, but our position is that a statutory change would be necessary to require that external ID to maintain, for that deer to maintain that external, that dangle tag, if you will, on a release, and that's what he was referring to. Obviously, on this broader subject, I would very much prefer that this commission continue to have the authority to make these decisions, if I may say that. And I think that addresses your question.
Okay. And I guess, you know, another issue or that gives me concern as we look at the, you know, voting yes or no on these rules, there's kind of a whole another back door out there that I guess we don't have any authority or control over, but would you agree that we have interstate transfer of elk and red deer coming into the state and released in the wild that really we don't have any control over?
I do agree with that as an agency. I think to continue with that response, two wrongs don't make a right.
No, I agree. I'm just, you know, there. Well, and maybe a little bit too late, because it worries me that it seems like the deer breeders are kind of taking the fall for this, and it just seems like that's not fair. And I wonder, do you have any solution? Do you have any resolution? I was kind of getting to that with the legislative angle on this movement of other animals that carry CWD that are effectively unregulated, in my opinion.
Well, and I'd like to appreciate another opportunity to take another swing at that, because I wouldn't say unregulated. Texas Parks and Wildlife Department doesn't have the regulatory authority regarding the movement, inter or intrastate movement of some of these other susceptible species, such as elk, sika deer, etc. But these other susceptible species cannot move interstate into Texas from outside without not only being enrolled in the herd certification program by USDA, administered by Texas Animal Health Commission, but also with a certified status. So, as you know, that certified status doesn't provide, you know, absolute assurance that these animals won't get the disease, as we're dealing with some certified herds that have the disease, but these are coming from monitored herds. Now, the movement within the state, there's less confidence that we're not moving CWD positive exotic susceptible species within Texas. The concept that deer breeders are getting the blame, they're getting It's not fair that they're having to do this testing and others aren't having to do testing. We have testing requirements for anyone who is authorized to move white-tailed deer in this state. And so that's and mule deer, and that's the issue here. It's not, and you've heard me say this before, and I mean it sincerely, this isn't finger-pointing, at least not from this agency, to the permitted deer breeders. We're not saying they brought in the disease. We're not. All we're saying is when deer are moved in a trailer from one location to another, there is a risk of transmitting this disease, a very real risk, which is we have a proposal to suspend the Triple T program because we're not comfortable with the level of risk currently within that program. We want to bring that program. We want that program to resume, but we want to be able to better address that risk. So these other people who aren't required to test aren't moving this risk. Now, some may come up here and argue, well, hunters are. They're moving these carcasses. There is nowhere near the level of risk of moving a carcass as there is a live deer that has CWD. There's some risk. We acknowledge that. But magnitude's difference in risk between those. So it's what we're trying to do, as I said yesterday, is strengthen a program so that we can continue with these practices out there, and some call them business models, whatever you want to call it, so that we can continue with these activities of releasing deer that are raised in captivity without adding additional risk, introducing additional risk to the native populations and others who depend on those neighboring populations.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you, Bobby.
Back to Bobby's question. Correct me if I'm wrong, Bob. I don't think you ever answered your question about the monitoring on elk or any of the other deals. We don't have any monitoring on elk or all that, do we? You jumped over into the whitetail deal, but we don't have any deal. We don't test the herds. We don't know where the elk and everything are coming from, do we?
Yes, we do. I apologize if I wasn't clear. When they're coming from out of state, they're coming from monitored herds. They're coming from herds. If they're coming legally, they're coming from herds that test 100% of the mortalities in the herd. They're in the USDA Texas Animal Health Commission herd certification program, and they have certified status. So they've been doing this for more than 5 years. Within Texas, there are some surveillance requirements, and it's changed some over the years, and I should know this from memory, and if Dr. Reed does, I welcome him to come up here and correct me. There is some surveillance requirements that are more similar to the requirements currently in our Triple T program for people that are moving elk or red deer or sika deer around the state. There's also a requirement by Texas Animal Health Commission for any landowner in the state of Texas, doesn't matter your high fence, low fence, doesn't matter, any landowner in the state of Texas is required to submit for testing the first 3 exotic susceptible species that's harvested on that ranch each year. First 3. It could be 3 axis, it could be 1, not axis, strike that from the record. It could be 3 sika, it could be a sika and an elk and a red deer, 2 red deer, 1 elk. First 3 from any property in the state of Texas each year is required to be tested post-mortem for CWD. So there's some. That's not a lot, but they do have a program that requires some surveillance from properties that do move these live animals around. I don't remember exactly the details of the program. It doesn't provide the same level of confidence of what we're proposing you for the deer breeder program today.
So you're saying that red deer, sika, elk, whatever, when they are brought in, USDA has to have tested that herd. Say it's coming from Colorado, just pick a place. So the USDA has to certify that herd is CWD free?
I would not use that terminology, Commissioner, Vice Chairman. But they will certify that this herd has tested 100% of the eligible mortalities for at least 5 years, or if they haven't, then they use some justification for why they maintain that certified status if they missed a mortality. So I certainly would not say certified free. Now, we also, our state veterinarian, it's not a rubber stamp. So let's say you have a certified herd coming and wants to bring deer into Texas from Colorado. We actually had a case, at least one case this year, where our state veterinarian did not approve that transfer. He has to approve each of these transfers. And he found out that a facility, despite having certified status, was in the same proximity of CWD and free-ranging animals. And he chose not to approve that transfer. So it's not a rubber stamp.
So just so I'm so that we're very clear on this point, because I think Bobby has brought up a very relevant one. So if the if this ranch in Colorado that's selling this elk or red deer, whatever, so if they have a herd certification from the USDA, every animal then that comes into the state has to have a paper trail that puts this animal back on this certified herd? What I'm trying to get to is what is the paper trail and who gets the paper trail that is proven up that this herd in Colorado is CWD free? I'm trying to understand how that works.
Okay, I'd like to stand by and defer to Dr. Reed, our state wildlife veterinarian, to address that.
This is Dr. Hunter Reed. I formerly worked with Texas Animal Health Commission, now wildlife veterinarian for Texas Parks and Wildlife. The executive director or state epidemiologist receives that paperwork from that respective herd. It has to show that they've undergone the proper brucellosis, tuberculosis, as well as engaged in the CWD herd certification program, and is in good standing within that state. That information, address, owner contact information is all forwarded in that paperwork, sent to Texas Animal Health Commission, and they say yay or nay. So the traceability of going back on those animals is there.
Any other commissioners, questions, comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a comment. One of the first things that you said today was that we're here today in spite of everything that we did in 2016 to try to contain CWD. And in the last 5 years or longer, because I think this process started before 2016, before the rules, the then temporary rules were made permanent rules, people were already working on this. And so many stakeholders from so many different perspectives and points of view have worked very, very hard, countless of hours, trying to come up with something to contain this disease, this very, very serious disease. Someone spoke about the money, and it's been millions of dollars have gone into studying this and trying to come out with something that was, yes, fair to deer breeders, but also lies within what we are here as commissioners charged to do. And I think it was Mr. Leslie that pointed it out and reminded us that we're here to manage and conserve the natural and cultural resources of Texas. That's our job up here. But we have done everything I think that we can as commissioners, as the agency, as the directors and stakeholders, to look at the perspective of the deer breeders and to take into account what they're going through. It was very hard to make these decisions. It's very hard to make these decisions and to implement those rules in 2016. And sometimes as a commissioner, I wonder, do the rules that I vote on, do they make a difference? Do they accomplish what we hope they'll accomplish? And all I can tell you is that all of us read everything that we can, that we receive. And if there's other research out there, someone said that we just get cherry-picked information to review, please send it to us. You can always send us things directly. I think all of our addresses are published, and it's public, because we do want to make the best informed decisions that we're up here. So I don't think there's any denying that we've tried our best as commissioners, as the agency, Mitch, everyone, to try to come up with the best rules for the situation that we're dealing with at this time. When we implemented those rules in 2016, some thought they were very harsh and that they were very restrictive. And we even came back as a commission and kind of amended them. But look where we are. It's not being contained. And they haven't accomplished what we thought they were going to accomplish then. So we're trying to contain this because there are all the other stakeholders, landowners, people that, you know, I think there was a young lady that talked about leasing her property and, you know, communities that depend on hunters to come in. And there's so many industries that depend on hunting in Texas. And we have to protect our free-range deer, too. We have to. And so I just wanted to make that comment because I'm one of two commissioners that was here in 2016 when we really deliberated and listened to every stakeholder that we could and took the information that we had and tried to make the best decision that we could. But unfortunately, those decisions we made and those decisions that we amended didn't contain the disease. And so that's why we're here today with these new rules in front of us.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Gala. Well said. I'm going to do a little clarifying, make sure I understand before we go any further, but I want to make sure if any other commissioners have questions or comments. See if I can get this right, and then Vice Chairman, you can tell me if I'm on board with this. As part of what we're going to vote on here in a little bit, one of them is in regards to Triple T, that Triple T will be a temporary postponement. We've made the commitment that we're going to work hard as an agency and we're going to report back as soon as possible, January, hopefully, March at the latest, and we're going to have done a deep dive on can we and how do we bring back Triple T, new and improved, safer, for the benefit and the tool that it provides. I also believe that part of this proposal that was mentioned yesterday that is not part, although we're temporarily suspending Triple T, we have removed all conversation or aspect that if there is a facility that ever received breeder deer, that it's forever not considered to be Triple T available, that has been withdrawn. And the fact that we're postponing all Triple T covers that base, but we will reassess that. We'll hear that in January. The commission will be able to take public comment, and we'll be able to make our own decision. So I want to clarify that. And then I believe Vice Chairman Scott's recommendation was to make a motion to approve these rules as presented, but he wants to sunset the antemortem, live antemortem 100% portion of the rules for 3 years, which means that part will automatically be sunset, and it'll be up to another commission at that time to deal with that 3 year. And I know Jeff mentioned he likes that. So, Dick, did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay. So I can't make a motion, but if I just want to make sure I got that right. So now if you want to make your motion, and we'll see if you can get a second.
So moved.
Is that good enough, James? Good enough. And who is seconding?
Hildebrand.
Commissioner Hildebrand is second. Any more discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? His motion, I believe, considers the entire thing, which includes Triple T, but we've talked about Triple T, and we've removed the forever part.
Okay, well, to be clear, Patton, I'm opposing. I'm voting against.
Understood. So, ayes, one, no. Is that how y'all read it? Okay. Very good. Then the ayes have it. And the motion carries. Mr. Schmidt, this commission has completed its business, and I declare it adjourned. And before I say the time, someone said there's been thousands of hours, and there have been literally thousands of hours. And I respect and appreciate both sides and the passion, and I just want to thank everybody for all the work on this very challenging issue. I declare this meeting adjourned at 11:28 a.m. Thank you.